Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
To Scarborough Fair, a once-had lover and I once lost him there.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Amy Garland? Y'all like Amy? Amy Garland has been playing guitar and writing songs since she was 9 years old. She says she will be playing as long as she is able. An Arkansas favorite, you can buy her latest CD, Hang a Light, on iTunes. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark can be heard on blues legend John Weston's CDs, Blues at Daybreak and Got to Deal with the Blues. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each show we feature an artist, and so tonight's featured artist is Little Rock painter Linda DeMint with this piece right over here, entitled Spring Morning Gift, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Linda at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight's stories are centered around our writers' families and the ties that bind them, whether it's siblings, parents, or grandparents. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Ann Hall and her sister devise an escape plan, and we'll end the night with Jillian Burgess Bougier, her grandfather, and some dirt. But let's start the night with Sandra Spots Hamilton and her whole family on a cross-country road trip in Arky's Head West.
The year was 1959, and I figured in my 10-year-old head that this was probably the most exciting thing my parents had ever done. Our bags were packed, the cooler was full, and we were setting out for a family adventure on the Mother Road, Route 66. Daddy, a salesman, must have had a good year because a few weeks before our vacation, he'd gone out and bought a shiny, new, two-tone aqua and turquoise 1958 Chevy Impala with air conditioning. The only thing he could have done better was to make it a convertible. But had Mr. Frugal made that move, Mama would have canceled the trip and had him committed, certain that he had gone off the deep end. My parents were suddenly displaying a level of cool never before demonstrated to me and sister. We were going to California, the ultimate vacation destination for the 50s. It seemed that everyone living in Arkansas during those post-Dust Bowl, post-war days had a family member transplanted to California who needed to be visited. The phrase, y'all come when you can, every Southerner knows, really just means bye-bye. But nobody said it couldn't be taken literally when the time was right, and that time was now. So we did take Daddy's youngest brother and family literally. He had joined the military during the war and upon discharge made the no-brainer choice of a California lifestyle over a return to the cotton fields of Northeast Arkansas. Seems that having smarts runs in our family. He had married and had my cousins, whom we'd seen only once on their brief visit back home, so we figured they needed a visit. Sister and I could barely contain ourselves since our parents agreed to let us visit Disneyland. Fortunately for us back then, a family of modest means could afford the Magic Kingdom without having to choose which kid would have to be sold in order to afford tickets for the rest. Mama had added a curious item to the agenda, a stop in La Jolla for us all to visit her boyfriend before Daddy, whom we had heard about way too much. I'm not sure if Daddy agreed to this because he figured he had held up better in time than Paul and wanted to show off, or if, since their marriage was a pretty volatile union, he was in hopes that Paul would take Mama off his hands. Either way, when the time came, it was an awkward situation for us kids. We backed out of the driveway in our cool new ride before daybreak, with the aroma of fried chicken wafting out from under the tablecloth covering the picnic basket. We hadn't made it out of the state before we were all clutching a napkin-wrapped leg, wing, or thigh. By the time we pulled into the roadside park, all we had left was one thigh, a neck, and a gizzard, and a couple of those other gross parts. No such thing as fast food existed, so we had to make do, filling in with Velveeta, Viennese, and potato sticks. After a few hours on the road, the novelty of oil wells and tumbleweeds had worn off. I tortured my family with imitations of the South Texas radio DJs, the fire and brimstone preachers, and cowboy songs sung off-key by my alter ego, Rex Titter. About an hour and a half into my performance, the rude bunch I lived with all yelled at me to stop. My pouting only lasted around 20 miles. Sister and I then resorted to noting license plates and keeping count of cars with and without radiator water bags. Finally, on day three, we arrived at our first tourist attraction, the Petrified Forest. All of us had been victims of our own vivid imaginations and expected a huge forest of petrified trees standing up like our still-living trees in Arkansas. Daddy, who was never easily impressed and never liked to show it when he was, dubbed it the Putrefied Forest. But then this is the man who, when we visited the Grand Canyon the next day, answered Mommy's breathless question, "Well, Bud, what do you think? Isn't that wonderful?" with, "Yep, mighty big hole." Dad's traveling style was to set a daily timetable and to never stray from it. So all we saw of Los Angeles was the freeway in the back of Daddy's head as he held a death grip on the steering wheel to guide the Impala safely through the traffic. Hopes of taking in the glamour of Hollywood and Beverly Hills were not to be. Sister and I soon recovered from that disappointment when we were dropped off at the gates of Disneyland, left on our own to experience the magic while our parents visited Daddy's cousin, another transplant from Arkansas. We were dizzied by repeated rides on the Alice in Wonderland teacups and the discovery of California boys. We had entered the gates of preteen heaven. With Daddy's arrival goals and not much else on the agenda, we finally arrived at Uncle Jay's house in Sacramento, where we got reacquainted with our cousins and the California lifestyle. While the adults reminisced and laughed over grown-up drinks, Sister and I ate supper in the den with the cousins and for the first time had something wonderful and exotic they called pizza pie. We refrained from exchanging cuisines with them, so the extra cans of Vianney stayed hidden in our picnic basket in the car. Daddy was relaxed and in top form the next day when we all set out on a day trip to San Francisco to see the sights and to visit Aunt Ava's mother and aunts. All nine of us managed to fit into Uncle Jay's station wagon, which came to a standstill at the direction of the California Highway Patrol as we neared the city center. Daddy hopped out and approached the group of officers on motorcycles lining the street. We waited to get the scoop on the delay, only to see our good old boy Dad posing with his arms on the shoulders of two of California's finest. He saluted his new friends and goose-stepped his way back to the car, to report that our trip was delayed by a high-ranking Soviet diplomat who was preceding Premier Khrushchev's visit in September. Later that day, Daddy went on to either charm or totally confuse an elderly Chinese-American man when we visited Chinatown. Daddy bought a Chinese newspaper and parked himself up against a lamppost, seemingly engrossed in reading the news of the day. The old gentleman circled Dad a couple of times, looked up at his red Scots-Irish face, and asked, astonished, in broken English, "You read Chinese?" To which Daddy drawled, "Oh, sure. I see here that a real important Russian fellow's in town." We kids had the run of the town when our cousins gave us a tour of the city. Later, we wore our coats and drank hot chocolate on a July night while we watched the newly transplanted Giants play at Candlestick Park. The pitcher got called for a balk when the wind blew him off the mound. Time to say goodbye to our relatives came way too fast, and we hit the road again, this time taking the northern route home. Daddy hit trip mode, and Mama entered her "the fun is over" funk at the same moment. The chemistry was explosive. Dad was determined to stop for nothing, and Mama was determined to let the good times play on. The result was an argument so hot that it took Sister and me years to get over. The conflict centered on Mama's insistence that we take a side trip to Yosemite and Daddy's insistence that we get home. The yelling went on for miles and miles and got louder and louder while we covered our ears in the back seat. Then Mama went for all-out drama, opening the car door and threatening to jump while we careened through curvy mountain roads. Daddy, a man not known for patience, somehow kept from swerving just a tiny bit more at that point. Either God answered our pleas from the back seat, or Dad realized he would have a lot of explaining to do if he returned home minus a wife. Somehow that car door was closed with Mama still inside. Since Daddy held the steering wheel and therefore all of the cards, we did not see Yosemite, and I never have. After driving endless miles through Kansas, we were hungry for the green hills of home. So Daddy, Sister, and I voted to drive through the night while Mama pouted. Daddy had us sing with him for hours to keep him awake for the rest of the trip. Finally, in the wee hours, with our heads full of the wonders of the West, we crossed the bridge into Little Rock, and Daddy belted out a solo. Something about when he was a baby, rocking in a cradle, and them old cotton fields back home.
Sandra Spotts Hamilton, a native of Little Rock, is a writer, artist, and designer. Remarkably, she counts travel as one of her favorite activities, even though she still will never visit Yosemite. Next, a stranger comes to visit, and Anne McElroy Hall and her sister take cover in Splitting the Half Dollar.
The day before, Granddad had announced that a relative from Texas would be arriving the following morning for a short visit to our house on Spring Street in Ozark, Arkansas. Granddad wanted me, my twin sister Charlene, and our brother David to be cleaned up and presentable for the visit. So the next morning, our mother dressed me and Charlene in plaid jumpers with crisp white short-sleeve blouses underneath. She combed our naturally curly hair to the side and clamped it down with barrettes. Mother kept our hair short in order to keep it under control. David was dressed in his navy blue Sunday trousers and was wearing a cotton shirt with a patch pocket, which our mother had made for him. We were told to sit in the porch swing and wait for the company to arrive. Mother wanted us to be on our best behavior as she left for work for the day at our father's store. David was making faces at us, and we were threatening to tattle on him. "Tell on me, and the visitor will take you with him when he leaves here," David snarled. Charlene and I ran inside and held on to our nanny's skirt. "What's wrong with you two?" Nanny asked. We told her what David had said, and she assured us that the visitor was a nice man, a man as old as Granddad, who certainly didn't want any more children. We believed Nanny, but were still upset with the impending visit. We scurried to our favorite hiding place under Nanny's bed. We had discovered that we could fit perfectly under the bed and listen to the conversation in the house without being discovered. Granddad, a former circuit-riding Methodist minister, had his own bedroom and office, while Nanny's bedroom had once been the dining room, complete with a fireplace. No one seemed to question why they didn't sleep in the same bed. They had generously turned their large main bedroom over to my parents. That was never questioned either. It was just something that was done in those days. There was a cozy rug on the floor under the bed, and Charlene and I had spent many hours there eavesdropping on the family and visitors who frequently popped into our house on Spring Street. Sometimes we would hear something funny and get so tickled that we kept our hands over our mouths, sure that no one ever heard us laughing. Meanwhile, a car had driven up outside. We heard a strange voice inside the front parlor, which was adjacent to Nanny's bedroom. It must be the visitor. We listened and heard Granddad call the visitor by name, Henry. A woman was with him, Esther. The conversation continued until this man, Henry, wanted to meet the children. He told our granddad in a very gruff voice, "I have a half dollar that I want to give the boy, but we will have to split the other half dollar between the twins." Charlene and I looked at each other. That meant only one thing. We couldn't bear the thought of cutting that half dollar. Besides, we didn't like the sound of his voice. Charlene said that we needed to get out of there. I agreed, and we slipped out the back side of Nanny's bed and crawled through Granddad's bedroom and office without being detected. "What will we do now?" I asked. I don't want to see that mean old Henry." Charlene said, "Run," and we did. We were little but fast. We headed down the lane for some rent houses that our grandfather owned. He rented the last one to some of his poor kinfolk, but he never actually collected any money from them. No one was around, so we quickly surveyed the situation. At one corner of the house was a large wash tub. I screamed at Charlene, "Let's get under that tub." I held it up and she crawled under and held the tub for me while I slipped underneath. We tried to hold our breath, but we couldn't contain the giggles. "Shh," whispered Charlene, "I hear someone." We could hear our granddad calling us. We could hear Nanny talking to the visitor and his wife. They were getting nearer. We heard them speaking to the poor relative who lived in the rent house. Granddad asked her if she had seen the twins. She must have pointed to the wash tub, as we instantly felt the tub being lifted off, and we were exposed to the family and the world. We clutched each other as Granddad and the visitor pulled us to our feet. "What have we here?" questioned Henry. "Why are you girls hiding?" "We don't like you," cried Charlene. I was trying to get away from the mean relative who firmly held my hand, and I was bawling at the same time. Charlene and I were literally dragged back to the house by Granddad and the visitor. I heard Nanny say to Esther, "The twins are so bashful, and they don't like to be around strangers." Esther shook her head in amazement. Henry said that he wanted to take a photograph of Granddad and the twins. "No, no, no," we cried. Henry tried to bribe us with a half dollar. Again, he said that Granddad would have to split it for us. That upset us both even more. The thought of that coin being cut in half was more than we could handle. We pictured a woodsman splitting wood in two with an axe. We started screaming, but Granddad held firmly while Henry snapped a picture. "Let them go now," Henry told Granddad. "Those girls need a good spanking." Charlene and I couldn't get away from there any too soon, crying so loudly that everyone in the neighborhood could hear. "Let's find another hiding place," I told Charlene. We remembered the thick hedge that separated our yard from the neighbors and crawled into a hole we had found there earlier. No one bothered us or even looked for us for the rest of the day. We were tired from the trauma and took a nap. The sound of the motor of the big car pulling away from the house woke us. Good, we both said at the same time, we can go home now. Not a word was said as two tired and dirty children made their way back to Granddad's porch.
A retired speech-language pathologist, Anne McElroy Hall, currently resides on a small farm outside of Little Rock with her husband Ralph and two horses, Bella and Sissy. She loves reading, writing, traveling, gardening, and spending time with her daughter, Catherine, and granddaughter, Reese. In our final story of the night, it's Jillian Burgess Bougier's grandfather that connects her in Soil for the Soul.
One of my earliest memories isn't of Christmas or a birthday. It's not of a lost tooth or of a monumental first in my life. It's of light and grass and dirt. Thinking of it now, I can nearly feel the warm sunlight mingled with the sweet breeze and cushioned by the cold emerald clover. I would lay there careless, enjoying the spring as only a 5-year-old could. My green streaked white dress didn't hinder my ambitions. I loved laying in that one spot. Above me, I would watch amber squirrels of all sizes leap from limb to limb and shaking tiny leaves that dotted the sky. My great-grandfather planted my favorite tree more years ago than I knew at the time. That orchard of pecan trees was my home. My papaw, my father's father, lived there after his parents. My dad lived there and lives there still. I didn't quite appreciate the dirt the way I should have, looking back now. I wish I had known just how precious that soil would be. J.D., Papaw said, limping his way towards me as I sat on the asphalt-covered driveway, slaughtering still-green balls that would eventually render black walnuts. Come on and walk with me. Papaw Mac and my Mimaw, as I called them, were a very big part of how I was raised. He moved slowly and slightly cockeyed. Not many people knew it, but when he was only about 2, his left leg was caught on a rope that was tied to a mule. The mule took off and broke his leg before he could be stopped. All of that occurred right behind where I played on a regular basis. I hopped up and skipped towards him, curious as to where we were headed. Papaw, where are we going? Come on, girl, just keep walking. So we did. The orchard, small by orchard standards, had 8 gigantic pecan trees that looked like they could touch the sky. To a little girl, this land went on for miles. To my papaw, it was his little home. My dad had chicken houses right back there, did you know? He looked toward the horizon, back towards the trees. Really? I didn't think we could play there, I said. You can't, he said, looking down just a little bit. We sold it years ago. Come on now, keep walking. So I kept onward, picking pecans up as I went, and trying to crack them together just like he did, with so little effort. It was a little harder for me. We walked a bit toward the worn-down field turn road that led behind the orchard back to the tree line. We used to have all this. He turned and lifted his hand, holding his tipless middle finger alongside his index finger, and waved it. My daddy farmed it all. I used to run around here just like you are now. I didn't wear shoes, though, he chuckled, looking at my jelly flip-flops. Mama said I have to, I said. You could tell I was not happy. She said I might get a nail or something in my foot. Yep, he said. It's happened to your dad and uncles out here before. He cleared his throat and looked towards our homes. My family lived just a brief walk from his front door in a trailer on the other side of my great-grandparents' house. Behind our home was the farm shop and surrounding it 2 very big pecan trees. Papaw, can we play out here? I asked. looking at the overgrown, forgotten fields dotted with cuckoo burrs and returning soybeans. No, not there either.
But why? I said. I thought you said...
We sold that too, he said, cutting me off hurriedly.
J.D., listen. Your papa did all he could. We still have a house, and they had a house, and we still have your trees. But through the years, money got tight. We didn't have much, and what we did have, we grew in the garden. It just...
He shrugged his shoulders. I looked at my grandpa. I saw a partially bald, red-headed man with red skin. I saw his kind eyes and his marbles that peeked through the front pocket of his snap-button plaid shirt. And I saw my hero, ever strong, soften just a tiny little bit. What's here? He said, looking around. What's left? That's yours. You can keep it. But you have to keep it. We walked back in silence. Well, silence other than me crunching random pecan shells under my feet. We found our way back to my hidden walnut stash. He looked at me and grinned. Your mama's gonna get you for that, you know. Yes, sir, I said, looking down at my very, very stained white dress. I think you're right, I answered and smiled. I watched him walk up the yard and under his mom's tulip tree, and then I waited until he found his way inside. Thank you, Papa, I said. I'll keep it. He just waved. A decade later, I watched helplessly as his land was pieced out and sold. My grandfather's business failed, and the IRS threatened to take it all, houses included. And so the land went again. My uncles and father scrambled to buy as much as they could as soon as possible, but little of their efforts worked. The lot behind my grandparents' home was sold to a neighbor. The lot behind the shop was sold to a land hoarder, as he's known in town. The lot behind my uncle's house was sold to a farmer. The orchard was sold to one of my uncles, who filed it on bankruptcy just a couple of years later. My father bought two lots and lives there still. Like a pie in front of starving mouths, I watched as the ground I promised to keep be divided and cut apart. And with every transaction, I watched my grandpa's smile just fade just a little bit until after a few years, it disappeared completely. J.D., how can you drive and listen to that at the same time? Increasingly argumentative with age, my papa's disapproving tone bellowed from the back seat of his very large car. Turn it over. Paul Harvey's coming on. Max, she's driving. Let her listen to her own music, my mamaw replied from the passenger seat. She looked out the window at the stagnant scenery. We made the hour and a half drive to Little Rock every day and had for weeks now. Chemo was Monday through Friday and radiation on Fridays. It's okay, mamaw, really. I'll turn it. It's okay, I said, turning the station and glancing in the rearview mirror to see if Papa's smile had returned. It had not. He don't smile much these days, J.D., Mama said, catching my eyes. It's okay. I just imagine he's smiling anyway. That was my grandma. She was a silly optimist. She smiled a bit, but only slightly. The drugs had made her so weak that even her signature smile was muted. When we arrived at the hospital and went through the routines, I sat beside Papa and handed him a cup of coffee. Thanks, he grunted. We sat silently looking around. Papa had already performed this routine. He was in remission from throat and tongue cancer when Grandma was diagnosed with cancer of the throat. We tried to ignore the heavy air and the nearly suffocating stench of dying hope. It doesn't matter what anyone says, a chemo room will forever be emotionally heavy for me. I watched the nurses put IV bag on its hook and heard the familiar beeps. I watched my mamaw try to make jokes with the newfound friends that smiled along with her. I held back tears and swallowed the big lump in my throat and then numbed it with hot coffee, just like my grandpa. She was my salvation in so many ways, and with each day, I drove her to her death. I often wonder how, if I had refused, if she would have died peacefully instead of enduring the hell of chemo and radiation. Papa watched the love of his life fade away slowly each day, sitting beside me in a very beige room. We sat, and we didn't talk about it. She died on a Wednesday, and we didn't talk about it. I walked into the home I loved so much to see medical bills mounding the kitchen table, the same that was once filled with home-cooked meals and surrounded by familiar laughs. I walked down the hallway and looked at the family portraits with her bright smile. And I wondered aimlessly for hours as he sat in his signature silence in her chair. I sat adjacent to him on the couch. "Well," he said, punctuating the deafening void, "the land's gone, and your mamaw's gone, and here we are, J.D. "Yes, sir," I said. I kept my sniffles quiet. "Yes, sir. Here." I looked up to see his familiar hand stretched toward me, holding something. I closed my eyes, trying with all of my being to keep from crying in front of him. He was not a crier. Opening my overflowing eyes, I saw a handful of dirt and a band of gold. "Keep them both for me," he said, sniffling. My hero of soft stone, the man known far and wide for his toughness. He didn't try to stifle his cries that time. Years of pain from watching his father's ground leave his grasp were topped off by the fresh heartbreak of losing his wife and partner, and there was nothing I could do to fix either one of them. The dirt and her wedding band were all that he could give me. "I know it ain't much," he mumbled, "but she wanted you to have it. And you know, I would have given you." He stopped short. His words left him. He looked up at the ceiling and cleared his throat. "I would have given you the world if I had it." "I know, Papaw," I said. "But you know what?" "What's that?" "This?" I whispered, holding the soul as if it was the last dirt I would ever touch, and that simple band in one hand, and holding his hand with the other. "This is my world." And we sat there, looking out the window, holding hands, sniffling in silence. That orchard was my refuge, but like any piece of ground, it is just dirt. The memories that made it aren't planted there. They can go with you anywhere. And I'm reminded of that every time I glance at the tiny jar of dirt that sits on my shelf. And beside it, a picture of me and my papaw smiling.
Julian D. Burgess Bougier lives on a farm in Wabaseka, Arkansas, with her two sons and her husband, Jonathan. Other than photography, she likes reading historical books, touring Civil War battlefields, and researching her family tree. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? All of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argento Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
My good friend Manny McBride sing with me on this. Since this evening is about family ties, here's one of the songs I wrote about my family. This song I wrote about my granddaddy.
Well, my granddaddy used to walk the line. He never wanted to see my grandma cry. He gave up the booze and the late night boys, then shuffled off to church in his corduroys. Yeah, he shuffled out to church in his corduroys. He grew up fast and he grew up poor. He grew up dancing on a hardwood floor. He grew up steady and he grew up clean. He grew up on living near Bayou Stream. Came from the Carolinas. He stomped across the promised land. He hitched a ride on a river boat, then cleared 100 acres with his own bare hands. My granddaddy used to walk the line. Never want to see my grandma cry. Gave up the booze and the late night boys, then shuffled off to church in his corduroys. Yeah, he shuffled off to church in his corduroys. Yeah. Didn't have a dollar and had bills to pay. He planned on saving all he'd make. He worked real hard from dawn all day, and he always had a good word to say. He always left a warm fire burning. When I come home, it'd be dark and gray. He taught me there was good in folks, and he tried to teach me to be that way. My granddaddy used to walk the line. He never wanted to see my grandma cry. Gave up the booze and the late night boys, then he shuffled off to church in his corduroys. Yeah, he shuffled out to church in his corduroys. Yeah, he shuffled out to church in his corduroys.
Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing, with additional support provided by AY Magazine, William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American Magazine. Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio Productions. Our graphics are by Robin Steves at Studio B. Our musician is Mark Simpson. Our stage art is by V.L. Cox. Our production engineer is Jay Jones. And our executive producer and host is Paula Morrell. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.